Welcome to the This Is His Story podcast, the executive director and pastor guide to sowing and reaping online givers. Today, we want to be encouraged and enlightened by listening to a special interview. This Is His Story podcast focuses on ministry backstories of people God is using for His kingdom work and those pouring out God's grace to hurting people around the globe. From Bible teachers to counselors to those that feed the hungry, pull people from dark places, and missionaries, we look into the events, personalities, callings, and circumstances of those God is using as His hands and feet.
Hello, and welcome to His Story. Today's guest is Harmony Grillo, founder of Treasures in Southern California. Harmony, thanks for taking time to be with us today.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Okay, so normally, before we get into the ministry of a person that we interview, we'd like to learn a little bit more about their backstory. In your case, your backstory ties in dramatically to your mission and your life's work. So would you just talk a little bit about where you grew up, what kind of family situation you were in, and we'll go from there.
Are you ready? No, I'm just kidding. Yeah, absolutely. Because the work that I'm doing today is completely based on and birthed out of my story and my history. So I was raised in Venice, California, and in a neighborhood where there was a lot of gang rivalry. There was a gang war, actually, for most of my childhood. So it was an unsafe situation there. And then also my home was really chaotic. My mother struggled, unfortunately, with a drug addiction. She herself had a history of trauma. So there was just a lot of brokenness that was repeated and, you know, just generational cycles that were passed down to me. And one of the things that really kind of shaped everything was, first of all, history of abuse and rape. That was a big, big factor for me. You know, it was years before I could speak about that. I used to think if I ever said that I had been sexually abused, you'd have to put me in a straitjacket because I couldn't even just form the words. It was something that I was so ashamed of because I really blame myself, like many victims do, for those situations, even though I was a child. One of my abusers was one of my mother's boyfriends. And at that point, I was 13. I started standing up for myself. And I finally ran away from home to get away from the situation. And, you know, unfortunately, my mom, you know, she didn't protect me from what was happening. She taught me the thing that she learned when she was a kid, which is, it's your fault. And she said, you know, if you weren't wearing shorts and tank tops, this wouldn't be happening. This is how men are, Harmony. You should know how men are. And I think she was just trying to teach me the ways of the world, but, you know, obviously that was a very broken message to receive. So she finally had him leave and told me I could come home and that things were fine and I'd be safe. And I came home, and then she ended up leaving to follow him to Canada. And she left me at 13 with my 8-year-old brother for 3 months with $20 and a book of food stamps. And obviously that didn't last long. I started stealing from the liquor store to support us. And that is when I became involved in a relationship with an older boy in my neighborhood, who when he was around, I didn't have to steal food because he'd buy it. And when he was around, I felt protected because he would tell me, anyone messes with you, I've got your back. Mm-hmm. And that meant a lot, like in a situation where we literally hear gunshots every single night, you know, to have someone looking out for you meant a lot. And so I became very deeply attached to him in what I now understand as a trauma bond. And, you know, now we train people and help people understand, you know, exploitation and how and why people stay. And one of those factors is the trauma bond, the kind of bond that's created between an abuser, an exploiter, a trafficker, and their victim. And so certainly that was operating very deeply and intensely in my life. And ultimately, that relationship, you know, was abusive and led me to working in strip clubs at the age of 19 under his control, with him being my pimp. And just was in a really awful downward spiral of life. Yeah.
So, you know, I normally ask people to talk about mentors or positive people in their life and their childhood. And in your case, it sounds like you were surrounded with negativity, right? So I'm going to change my question. Is what what did you gain from that, from the childhood? Like, what characteristics or positive traits have you that you carry today were birthed by the type of life that you live? Because that's a rough, rough life.
Well, you know, actually, so first of all, I mean, I'm a fighter. You know, that was the way I responded, was to be a fighter. I mean, maybe it took a while for me to find that fight, but I do want to actually speak to the question you were thinking of asking but didn't. Okay. And it's the positive influence, because obviously my family of origin, I didn't have that, you know, in my immediate family. However, I really do believe that safe, positive relationships are so important in building resilience in children and developing the ability to have healthy, secure attachment. And so even though in a lot of ways I wasn't able to experience that with my parents, and with the people around me, I had a grandmother and I had an aunt, and they had a huge role in my life. First of all, my grandmother was a Southern Baptist, and she was a praying woman, so I know she was praying for me. But she made an effort to have relationship with me, and she made an effort to show me love, and she gave me an opportunity to develop secure attachment, and also an opportunity to see a different life. Although I felt for a very long time, I thought her life is so different than mine. She could never understand what I'm going through. And most of it, she didn't know about, right? Most of it was kept hidden from her. But eventually when I learned more about her, and that she actually grew up in poverty, and that she had had, you know, some experiences that were very traumatic and shaping, and that she overcame that. Mm-hmm. When I finally realized that in my 20s, I had such, it ignited such hope in me that I could have a different life too, and that my past didn't have to determine my future. So I say all that because I really, you know, what I do today, and we're not there yet, but in encouraging and training other people to do this work and work with victims of exploitation and trafficking, but to know that we can have such a positive impact and a positive influence in the lives of other people as through relationship, through positive relationships. There's this guy, I forgot his name, but he wrote this book called The Boy Who Was a Dog. And he is a trauma expert. And he is one of the people that's called to, when there's just severely traumatic things, you know, like Columbine, or, you know, what was the one where they, with the Kool-Aid. And so anyways, he works with trauma victims. You can Google it. Listen, I'm not Google, but Google it. But one of the things he talks about is sometimes the most therapeutic thing a person can experience is not therapy, but therapeutic relationship. Mm. And so what he found is that the people that were more resilient and did better at overcoming trauma were not the ones with the best therapist, but the ones with the most positive relationships. And so I say that to encourage people who are listening and maybe have people in their life that you're like, what can I do? Their life seems so far gone. What difference could I make? You can invest in them and you can make a positive impact in their life.
Wow. I think we're going to circle back to that in a minute.
Yeah.
With your work now, but that's a great point. Thank you for stopping there for a minute.
Yeah.
You mentioned that you're a fighter. Is that a personality trait that still stays with you today? I mean, I can only imagine living a life where you have to sort of compartmentalize your life. But
yeah,
you know, are you still a fighter? And if so, what does that mean?
Just ask my husband. No, I'm just kidding. I'm not a fighter like that. But yeah, you know, I do think, you know, it's nature, nurture. I come from a long line of really strong women. Huh. So there is just something wired in my personality where I do think that, you know, I'm pretty tenacious, you know, and another thing that contributes towards resilience is optimism. And I do have a tendency to be, I'm not completely Pollyanna, rose-colored glasses, but I'm optimistic. I can usually find the silver lining. I can usually see, you know, the good in a situation. So nice. I think those things help.
We're going to talk a little bit about your college later, but were you a good student in all this, or were you just passing school, or have you always been a reader and a learner?
So for most of my childhood, for most of my education, I was, and I even despite everything that was going on, you know, in my home, I kept my grades up and kept the smile and blah, blah, blah. But then it took a turn in junior high, and things really started going downhill. And in high school, I almost didn't graduate. I got called in and they said, if you miss one more day of school, you're not graduating. And in fact, you know, when I applied to colleges, I didn't get into any of them because my grades were so bad. But when I was living in a group home, when I was a teenager, my mom unfortunately was also physically abusive, at times. And so I ended up living in a group home temporarily. And the residential counselor in the group home, one day he said, okay, I've got to end our meeting because I have to leave. I go to college. And I knew him because he was from the same neighborhood as me. And the idea that he was in college was just like really kind of preposterous to me. Cause I just thought like, what's the point? And he looked at me and he said, because I'm going to be the first Black president of the United States. It was not Obama. That would have been really cool if it was Obama.
It'd be a great story.
It would be a great story if it was Obama. But I was so moved by his, just the hope that he had for his life that I made a decision that day, I promise you, that education was going to be a life raft for me and that I was going to apply myself to school. That's one thing I could do. I couldn't control so many other things that were happening in my life, but I could apply myself to school. And from that day forward, I started working towards getting all A's. And in fact, I went through all of undergraduate with, I think, one B and graduated magna cum laude from UCLA and then got a master's degree as well. Wow. Because of that one comment.
Wow. And did you go to school in the middle of you know, stripping and all that?
Was
that all at the same time?
I did. And, you know, I'm someone I didn't, many people who are experience exploitation, work in the sex industry, use drugs and alcohol. Mm-hmm. For me, I had such an intense history of trauma. I was able to very easily dissociate and just kind of detach from my reality. So I didn't use drugs and alcohol, but one of the ways that I escaped was through education. When I say I decided that was my life raft, it was how I coped with the chaos in my life was to dedicate myself to education. And I studied psychology, ironically, and I got my master's in social welfare, but I got my bachelor's in psychology. But I think a lot of that was driven by a desire to understand my own craziness and make sense of my life.
You're making me jump so far ahead of my questioning, but I'm going to have to do it because it segues so nicely. So did you see I feel like there's two things, because I know a little bit more about your story. A lot of women feel trapped into their situation. At the same time, you're pursuing education. In your mind, did you think, as soon as I get this degree and get a real job, I'm out of here? Or were you just trying to get educated and you didn't know there was a way out? Is that a fair question?
I did. I did hope that education would give me a way out of the commercial sex industry. I didn't understand at the time, and this is the thing with the kind of manipulative tactics that exploiters use. I didn't understand that my boyfriend was my pimp. I didn't see that I was being exploited because he, you know, sold me the lie that this is temporary, you know, at the end of this, it's going to be you and me. We just have to do this for a little while. And it was supposedly a means to an end, but there, and now I look back and I realize that for him, there was never an end,
right?
You know? So,
okay. So sorry for my lack of education. So I'm going to ask some crazy questions because I don't understand the difference when we talk about, you know, sex trafficking. I mean, in my mind, I guess the naive part is stripping is stripping. I know what prostitution is. And mm-hmm. then we hear the word like sex industry and trafficking, and I don't get it. So I want to ask some questions
yeah.
for you to explain. It doesn't have to be all your story. You've lived,
yeah.
you know enough to know mm-hmm. way a lot more than I do and what our audience does. So, you know, Jerry Falwell, the old, Southern Baptist preacher, he had a good line of like, you don't have to stick your head in the gutter to know it smells, right? So we know it smells. We know this industry is bad, but I don't... Talk a little bit about it, because stripping is not just taking off your clothes, getting in the car and going back home. It's a lifestyle in an industry that's
right.
harder than most people know. Could you just dig into that a little
yeah,
bit?
Yeah, totally. So I appreciate you bringing this up because there are some important distinctions to make. So you hear me use the word exploitation. You hear me use the word trafficking. We're talking about commercial sex industry. So basically, exploitation is when someone uses the attractiveness or sexuality of another person for their own personal gain. That's exploitation. Okay. It only becomes trafficking when, according to the federal definition, there's force, fraud, or coercion involved, or the person is under 18. So exploitation becomes trafficking when that person is tricked, coerced, forced through physical violence or emotional manipulation, or that person is a minor, then it's trafficking, right? Okay. Now, where things get a little bit dicey and where people maybe have some different perspectives is I am of the mindset that the commercial sex industry is inherently exploitative for a few reasons. One, if you look at all the body of research around the women who end up in the sex industry, it's the most vulnerable in our society that are the most susceptible, right? So it's vulnerable people that are ending up more often than not in the commercial sex industry. Are there exceptions to that? Absolutely. Research shows 89% want to leave but don't see any other options. So there's an 11% who say, I want to be here, great. But there's 89 who say, I don't have any other options, right? And then when you look at the way the commercial sex industry is set up in different ways, you know, in the different areas, it fits the definition of exploitation because someone else is profiting off of the sexuality or attractiveness of another person. Then when a woman works in a strip club, you know, depending on how the strip club is set up, she pays a house fee to work that night, right? If she doesn't make enough money, she can walk away owing the house money and not making any money, even if she worked, right? Or, you know, you have to cash out and tip a percentage to the managers, the door guys, the bouncers, the bartenders, the cocktail waitresses, right? So all of these other people are profiting off of your sexuality in that case. So in that way, I'm of the mindset, you know, that it's inherently exploitative. But at the end of the day, those are that's the distinction, exploitation versus trafficking. And the thing is sometimes it's not always so cut, you know, black and white in the course of a person's story. Like, so for example, this is a quick example. There's a woman, and then often you see a history of trauma and abuse, very common for those of us that have experienced this, right? So a woman comes to us, history of trauma and abuse. She's working. She had been forced into prostitution by a pimp. And then another guy comes to her and says, you don't have to work in prostitution. You can work in strip clubs, make plenty of money. I'll help you escape him. And, you know, you only have to pay me 20% as a manager, right? So he's using some coercive tactics, right? But he's doing more exploitation versus trafficking, although it could be argued that even that's trafficking, right? Sure. Eventually, she finally gets the courage to leave him and she, you know, ditches him and then is working in strip clubs on her own, of her own choice, right? So, and when she tries to leave, she can't find another job. So then the question becomes, what's choice without option? So here's a person who was initially trafficked, then she was exploited, and then she was in a situation where she would say she's there by choice, but you look at her history and you look at, you know, what she's faced with, what's choice without options?
Right. Okay, you don't know how much I want to go down that line, but I'm going to hold off. I want to go because I don't think we can get to the problem and how you're helping it without knowing your story of how you got out. So let's back
up. Okay.
Talk a little bit about how did you get
Rewind.
Out?
Rewind. Okay.
And what does that normally look like? Is your story special? Or is there, you know, talk about the industry. Start talking about your story, and then you can bleed that into other people's story. And what are the statistics of getting out, and what does that normally look like?
Right. Yeah. I just first want to say that my story is not special or unique. It's not even particularly, when you hear our stories, it's not even particularly, I don't want to compare, but like extreme, right? Like there are people with way more extreme stories than mine. And at the end of the day, God is not a respecter of persons, and what he did in my life, he can and will do in the lives of other people. So I just want to say that I am not special in that sense. I'm special in the way that we're all special, right. You know, but I'm not special.
Right.
So for me, my journey out really began with a relationship. I met a girl whose friendship changed my life. She loved me unconditionally, and she showed me the unconditional love of God. She did not, our friendship was not contingent on me going to church with her. She'd invite me, but when I didn't want to go, because that's the last place I wanted to be, I thought, if there is a God, then I don't think he likes people like me. And I don't know if I like him. And so, but she didn't let that stop her. She'd take me to frozen yogurt. We'd spend time together. And she showed genuine care and love for me as a person. And I never felt like a ministry project. That would have so turned me off. I would have run the other way. If I sensed that, if I smelled that, people can sense it. When you think they're a project rather than a person, they can tell. And so, but she loved me unconditionally. I finally took her up on her offer to go to church. And what I experienced was this sense that I am home. And I wanted to keep coming back, but my life was still my life. It didn't change overnight. Mm-hmm. And the gift that she gave me is space to work that out. She never tried to be the Holy Spirit. Mm-hmm. She never said, now that you're at church, get off the pole, break up with the boyfriend, put on some clothes, stop cussing, right? Like, give me the rules, right? She really loved me and gave space for the Holy Spirit to speak to me and do a work in my heart that ultimately led to change in my life. Mm-hmm. And that's really the model for the way we do care at Treasures today. And I think a lot of times what the church tries to do is say, if you behave and believe, then you can belong, mm-hmm. right? If you behave and you believe, then you can belong, then we'll accept you. That never would have worked for me. I wouldn't be sitting here today if that was how she tried to reach me, right? Perfect. But what she did, and what I think is way more powerful, is if we our actions, our behavior, our communication demonstrates you belong. You belong. And it's from that place of belonging that then we'll be inspired to believe. And from that place of belonging that maybe we'll consider some different behaviors, right? But it's from knowing that we belong.
Isn't that great? I love how the Bible, works, and it's timeless. It's the same idea of the Pharisees saying, behave, yeah. and you're in, and Jesus going to eat with the sinners and loving.
Right,
them.
Right.
The same thing you just said. He did it.
He's
did
saying
it.
You belong. Yeah. Right, exactly.
He sort of knows what he's talking about, right?
Yeah.
Okay, so, you're out, and I don't know whether we're talking years or decades here, but at some point, you wrote a book, and at some mm-hmm. point you decided to invest into a ministry to help other people. So talk about that journey, and how long did that take from leaving to helping?
Yeah. So I remember I've always had a heart to do something meaningful or help other people, but my life was just too much of a wreck to actually do that. Right. But I do remember actually one night sitting in the strip club, and I looked over at this woman and I said, I think I'm going to write a book about this one day. And she was like, what? And I was like, yeah, I think I'm going to write about this. And I was in the midst of it, but I just had that sense. And then when I left, I really had this strong sense that the choices I made mattered, and that I was going to have to give an account for them, that I was going to have to share my process to help other people one day. So it gave me this increased level of accountability that what I'm doing today is going to matter, not just in my own life and for those outcomes, but for other people. And that's certainly the case. And what is kind of unique about my story is I was not out that long and hadn't been in recovery that long before I started Treasures, which I mean, it's by the grace of God, we're still here. So I left the industry, and I mean, I started Treasures in 2003, and I left the industry in 99, I think, maybe 98. So not that long, especially with the kind of trauma that I had been through. But I'm a tenacious person. And when I committed myself to healing and recovery, I committed myself to healing and recovery very fully. Listen, I was still a hotmess.com. Like, I look back and I'm like, I had no business.
Right.
Deciding to start a ministry. Yeah. What was I thinking?
Heal yourself, right? You had to work on yourself, and you're already helping others.
Right. Yeah. But God's grace is sufficient. Yeah. And really it was birthed out of need. There was no one doing anything like this 20 years ago.
Okay.
And I found myself sitting across the street from the club where I used to work. And I knew that I needed to do something to reach the women still working inside. And the vision of Treasures was birthed that night. And we started out with just strip club outreach. Now we do outreach to women in online forums who are being exploited, women in porn through HIV testing sites, and then also girls in juvenile detention centers. So we've expanded outreach since the beginning. And then just once we started reaching them, like, we have to do something to care for them. So I developed a mentoring program. And then down the line, we developed support groups. And now we do both of those things to this day. And then again, birthed out of need, we had people. There was a situation where my story was featured in Glamour magazine and our phone lines crashed, our website crashed, our everything crashed because of all of these people, all these women from all over the world reaching out for help, wow, looking for support. And we were doing our best to meet those needs, but we also recognize that this work is best done locally by people who can, you know, have relationships. So that's why we started training people to replicate this model of outreach in their cities so that when someone contacts us, you know, from another city, hopefully we have something pretty relatively nearby that can support them. And we've had the opportunity to train in about 120 cities now all over the world. And so it was, all of it was really birthed out of need.
So what I hear here is that you knew you were in the middle of the problem. You look back and you want to help people out of it. But over the course of the last, 15, 17 years now, yeah, you've matured how you attack this because you've learned a lot over time.
Oh, yeah. And I'm still growing. I'm still learning. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I'd say that's the other thing that has been a benefit to me is I have a hunger for growth and learning. I think that's really been helpful. And then similarly with my memoir, Scars and Stilettos, it took me like 7 years to write it because I was not a good writer. I had to learn how to write. Oh. I got a publishing deal, yeah, right off the bat, and they gave me the advance. And then when I turned in the manuscript, they were like, no. And I was devastated. And I actually had to go and take writing classes with professional writers and learn how to write. And then
I don't think anybody's born a writer, by the way. I think,
oh my gosh, it's an yeah, art form, right?
Yeah, it is.
But it was so worth it. So,
the book came after.
So I started Treasures in 2003, and then I released Scars and Stilettos, the first edition, in 2009. And we're getting ready to release the audio version. I'm so excited.
Well, that's great. Yeah. Okay, so I'm going to backtrack just a little bit. So explain, I know there's nothing typical, right? I mean, but I guess there's averages. How long is somebody in the sex industry and how do they normally get out? Is it normally bad news of how they get out? And is it in their 20s? Like, are you just going in and whoever's in the building is who you're ministering to? Or have you sort of calculated when's a good time to hit them? And what's their road if you don't save them from the industry? Like, what happens to them?
Yeah. So obviously it varies hugely from person to person, but when we did a survey, we have about, maybe 1500, 2000 women that we have their contact information that have reached out to us over the years. So we did a survey of them to find out some of the answers to the things you're talking about. One of the things that we found is about 90% of them entered the commercial sex industry before the age of 24, many of them as teenagers. And so what's interesting about that is when you think about brain development and when you think about our prefrontal cortex that doesn't finish developing until the mid-20s, which is where decision-making comes from, okay, that a lot of times people are making the decision to enter the commercial sex industry well before their brain has finished developing. Now, when you look at a person who has had trauma, that affects brain development and that makes that, you know, period of even further out, right? So the frontal cortex is affected by trauma. So that's one thing. Many of them started very, very early. And then when it comes to how long they're in, it really varies from person to person. But I literally I know firsthand of women in their 80s, I kid you not, escorting. Kid you not. Obviously, that's the extreme end of the spectrum. What we see at Treasures a lot, so, you know, we work with juvenile detention centers, we work with Department of Probations, and build relationship with a lot of the young women. A lot of times it's not until they're in their either late 20s all the way up through the 40s where they start to say, oh, I actually need some help and I need to make a change here. Obviously, we hope that happens sooner. There's intervention happening so that it does.
Sure.
But kind of left to their own devices, that's what I'm see happening is it's usually not until late 20s at the earliest, 30s and 40s, that women start to say, oh, I feel really stuck and I could use some help here. That's what I see.
So I know I've read either an article or a video of you talking about people who get out and the cycle of getting back in. And I'm assuming money is a huge factor, right? If you're making really good money and then you go try to get a regular job and you're like, I can't even pay my bills. But is there something else besides money that draws you back into the lifestyle?
There are a lot of different factors. You know, a lot of it comes down to, in my opinion, identity. Once a person has made a decision or has been forced into the commercial sex industry, there's this sense that now I'm that person that does that. And so that when I remember, you know, during the recession, I was leading treasures and I would have the thought, you could make $1,000 tonight. Now, I would not do that. I would not make that choice. But that thought is right there, because once you've done that, you know you can do that. And when things get scary, like right now, that's what we're seeing. We're in the middle of the coronavirus crisis, right? So we're seeing people get scared. Financial future is uncertain. And as humans, we tend to want to go back to what's familiar and do the things that we know we can do to try to control, right? And so anyways, but the other thing too, when you talk about going back, that's very common. And one of the things that we talk about in the trainings we do to train other people to do this work is we talk about the stages of change. Mm-hmm. And there's a model that looks at, you know, there certain people might be in pre-contemplation. They're not ready to change at all, right? Other people are in contemplation. They're thinking about it. They're weighing it out. They're starting to think about it. Then some people might start to take action, right? And then other people are in maintenance, where they're maintaining the choices and the changes they've made. But relapse or recycling, going back into the behavior, is a normal part of the recovery process. So it's not uncommon for people to go back, but it doesn't mean that they're not still hopefully moving forward towards change, towards lasting change.
Sure. All right, I've got to ask this question. You mentioned it earlier that it was advice from your mom, as even as a kid. But I was thinking about this today. If you're in the sex industry, and every man, not every, but most of the men you talk to are looking at your beauty, or they're selfishly, what, you know, what can you do for me mentality.
Right.
There, how do you, is it even possible? How do you train somebody that not all men are pigs? Because you know what I mean? Like,
it's
a while to untrain yourself, or unfortunately,
oh, yeah,
they get a lot of affirmation that men are pigs even after the sex industry, right?
Totally.
So what,
right.
How did your heart change, and how long does it take? And I guess some people never get over that thought.
Right.
We don't help.
Definitely. It's definitely a struggle. The reason I laughed is because I'm going to tell you a story. This is how I met my husband, my wonderful, amazing husband, Chris Grillo. So I was speaking at our church, talking about treasures, obviously leading treasures. He comes up to me afterwards and he was like, man, I have such a heart for what you're doing. I would love to get involved somehow. And I looked at him, I go, no. And he was like, okay. And he felt like such an idiot. And I remember that day so clearly. It was in 2008. I remember it so clearly because he seemed genuine and I didn't have a paradigm for that. That didn't make sense to me.
Yeah.
And he remembers that day very clearly because he felt like just dumb, you know?
Yeah.
He was like, what was I thinking that I could get involved with this? But kid you not, at that time, because I wasn't known as Harmony Grillo, leader of treasures, right? Whatever. People in the church would come up to me, men, and say, I heard what you do. You go to strip clubs. I'd love to go with you to strip clubs on a Friday night. In the church, right? So that's not helping. That's not helping me develop trust for men. But what ended up happening is about 6 months after that moment that I met, who is now my husband, a woman who worked with me convinced me to let a male that she trusted, she vouched for, intern. I was like, he can come in here when the women are not here. He can sweep the floors. He can clean the toilets. He can take out the trash, but he can't do this and this and this and this and this and this. And she's like, okay. So he starts coming in and building trust. And here I see this man. I'm like, this person, he genuinely seems to care, and he's not creepy, and there doesn't seem to be any ulterior motives. He convinced me to let him find a couple other men that could help him take out the trash and sweep the floors. And my husband was the first to sign up. He wasn't my husband then.
Yeah, yeah.
And so he was in my office every week, every Thursday, just helping with whatever needed to be done. And then as they built trust, you know, we started having them do security on outreaches, do security for support group. Now they cook a Thanksgiving dinner for the women and cook it from scratch, gourmet dinner, and serve it to them in suits and, you know, volunteer at events. And they're now known as Men for Treasures, and they're amazing. And it wasn't until, I don't know, 6 or 7 years later that finally my husband and I started dating from the time we met. Wow. But I still didn't trust men, you know, and it's a whole nother story, but I had a previous marriage where that contributed also to my lack of trust. But
sure.
Now I see and believe and know that there are great men out there with just a genuine heart for women. And he has so much passion for the work that I do and supports it so deeply. Mm-hmm. And he loves and honors me and shows me that with his actions.
Yeah, I'm assuming there's a lot of layers to leaving the industry. And that's just one of the layers, yep. Is trusting men again. But I'm sure that's not the most important thing. As you're trying to pull people out of the lifestyle.
But you know, it's high on the list, you know, because it's until we develop new behaviors and patterns, a lot of us end up in dysfunctional relationships and toxic patterns of relating that are just
spirals you right back down.
Yeah.
Interesting. Okay, so let's talk a little bit about further. Like, so what is your ministry look like? I mean, obviously, like we said, you matured it over time, but if it could just be boiled down, like, do you literally walk into a strip club and start talking to people and letting them know you love them and try to build relationships? And like, what does that look like?
Yep, pretty much. We do outreach to all the clubs in LA, and we bring gifts to the women and just with our contact information and let them know if and when they're ready and need some support, we're here for them. The message is that you're loved, valued, and purposed. And, you know, when the managers are like, what are you trying to get the women to leave? No, I've never in 17 years told someone to leave the sex industry. I've never had to. If the research is true and my experience is it is, 89% want to leave, right? They just don't see other options.
Right.
I don't have to know. And the ones who don't, I'm not here to convince them, right? But for the ones who want support, then we're here for them. And the relationship that we have developed with the clubs is pretty great. In most cases, like, a lot of the managers give the women our contact information. And so we've really developed some great rapport with the clubs. And then when a woman reaches out to us, it's from that point, just building that trust, building rapport, building relationship, and being there for her and walking alongside her in whatever way she invites us to.
Wow. So I'm amazed to hear that they don't try to keep you out. So what advantages?
A couple do. Don't get me wrong. A couple do. Right. Yeah, but a lot of it. So here's the reason, though. Here's the mentality that there's nothing inherently. This is the mentality. There's nothing inherently wrong with the sex industry. So if someone needs to use drugs to be here, has a pimp, has blah 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 going on in their lives, then that's her. That's not the industry. That's her. And a lot of the managers are like, we feel like therapists. We're constantly having to deal with their problems. So if they can go talk to someone else, that's great. Wow. And for every, let's say someone does leave, right? Let's say, and this has happened. We've actually had this one female manager who said to us, you know, I don't like when you come here because you make the girls think and we don't want them thinking. Mm-hmm. But let's say someone does leave. There's 25 other women auditioning on a Friday night.
Yeah, so they want that. They're willing to pay to be there, and there's a line out the door.
Right. So they're, yeah.
Okay.
So we're not hurting their business.
No. Yeah, right. All right. So this is a sad part. So I think this ties into my next question. How has the internet changed all this? What, I mean, if there was already strip clubs and there was already people who are coerced or opportunistic to go into that lifestyle, now I have the internet. I mean, I've seen documentaries of people just put ads online, and there's, once again, so many emails that flood in that people want to be in the industry, whatever that means. That's right. A vague term. So right. How has this changed the sex industry in general, much less how you're attacking it?
Yeah, the internet has changed everything. So in so many ways, so many different facets of this are affected by the internet. So first of all, the accessibility of porn has led to an incredible increase in porn consumption. Okay. Increase in demand leads to increase in supply,
right.
Which leads to increase in exploitation.
Sure.
The internet is absolutely used as a tool for exploitation. So there are pimps and traffickers. They know that if they call their victim a porn star who's available for escorting, they can make more money off of her. So what that means is they make porn of the women, distribute online as a way of advertising their victims. There are a very high percentage of women in prostitution report being filmed by traffickers, johns. So a lot of this is happening without them knowing, and that footage is distributed.
And blackmailed, I'm imagining.
Blackmailed, well, right?
Because normally if at a strip club, what you do behind closed doors, you walk out and you can be whoever you want to be. But when you have evidence, right, and it's held over you, I can't imagine what living with that would be like.
And a lot of exploiters will use that. Like one of the things that they'll do is they'll find a potential victim. They'll, I mean, this is awful, but drug them, rape them, get it on camera, and then use that footage as blackmail. If you don't do what we tell you, we're going to send this footage to your parents. We're going to put this on, you know, make this public. So there are a lot of different ways that it's being used. Same thing with what we're seeing is a big push right now, especially with so many people in quarantine, a big push for women to go into webcamming because there's a huge demand for that right now as well. So the internet has really changed everything. And then of course the websites and the forums where women are being exploited online, right, you know, where they're posting ads, that sort of thing.
Okay, so you hit a question I was going to ask. I'm talking about supply and demand. At the end of the day, how does society tackle this epidemic? I mean, do you go for the supply side? Do you go for the demand side? Do you go attack everything at once? How do we fight this?
I mean, it has to be all of it, right? Because if the demand is never reduced, as long as there's a demand, there's going to be a supply. As long as there's a demand, there are women who are going to be exploited. So, you know, educating people, helping people understand. A lot of people are consuming porn thinking this is completely victimless, not understanding, even for your average person in porn, not someone who would identify as a victim of exploitation or trafficking, but the kind of coercion that's happening behind the scenes. It's very common for a person to get hired to do a certain thing, be told these are the parameters, and the parameters are within whatever their boundaries are. And then when they show up to the set, they're being asked to do something way different that they didn't sign up for, that they didn't agree to, and then told, if you don't do this, you're going to be blackballed. If you don't do this, we're going to do this, that, and the other. Name calling, you know, coercing them into doing these things. And that's even in porn that is not under exploitation and, you know, under trafficking, I would say. So, yeah, but as long as there is a demand, there's going to be a supply. So education is important, helping people understand, because I think a lot of people, if they did understand the kind of exploitation that they're participating in, would think, like, there's Fight the New Drug is an organization that I love, and one of their campaigns is consider before consuming. So considering, just consider the facts, consider the data, let alone the negative impact that porn has on relationships. And it's crazy because a lot of sex therapists recommend porn, right?
Right, right.
There's a very famous doctor who will remain nameless, who is very well respected in the evangelical world, who recently on a podcast recommended that couples use porn to enhance their sex life.
It's interesting because I used to live in Van Nuys, and I know that was sort of a hot spot in the porn a long time. I don't know, maybe it still is, I don't know. But
yep.
Back then, maybe the internet is changing this as well, but I don't think people were as famous. You may know their name, but now, I mean, there's conferences in Vegas, and there's the devil's so great at putting lipstick on evil and making it look great. And so I think there's not only money, but now the girls think they can get famous and rich from it. And that's got to be super hard to fight.
Totally. And yeah, exactly. I mean, so when you talk about how do you change this, there are, you know, cultural norms that are playing into this as well. As a society, we're very comfortable with women being sexualized and objectified. That's, you know, throughout all forms of media. And women and girls are growing up learning that their value is in their sexuality, and that fame and likes and followers are the most important thing. So those social norms and those mindsets are also contributing. So it's a beast, right? And then you have to be able to address demand. You have to address the social norms and mindsets. But then you also have to help the women whose lives are being just ravished by this industry and who want help and need support to get out. But you need all of it.
So we're probably running out of time, but this is so good. I could go on for hours, but just like you return to help. So the people that you help, are they going back and helping as well? Do you see a pattern?
Oh yeah. So one of the things that's unique about Treasures that I love about Treasures is we believe very much in survivor leadership. And my prayer from the beginning was that the women we reach tonight would be the future leaders in this movement. And we see that today. Our support group, we used to have a therapist-led support group, and it's a long story, but now we have a survivor-led support group, and our attendance skyrocketed once we did that. And so we have survivor leaders on our care team, our outreach team, survivor leaders, you know, that are mentors, survivor leaders that are leading support group, and many of whom, or most of whom, were initially reached and cared for by Treasures and then grew to a place where they wanted to give back. So that's one of my favorite things.
So you've tackled and you're tackling Los Angeles, and you said that you're sort of replicating this in other parts of the country. I'm assuming every mid-sized city to big city needs one. I mean, there could be
every city there.
Like
every city.
Okay.
Yeah.
Is there something in almost every city now, or?
Oh yes, there's something in every city. So you know, I'm in the San Fernando Valley, which is the adult industry capital of the world. One of the things we do is we do online outreach where we post in forums where women are being advertised, right? We, one morning at 10 a.m. on a Thursday, put up a post, 15 minutes later went back to check on it, and we couldn't find it because it was buried beneath, I think, like 60, 70 other posts within a 5-mile radius of women being advertised for sex. So we're in the epicenter. But I like to go on to these websites when I'm in other places, small towns, this, that, and the other, and just see what's being posted, you know, in those places. And everywhere you go, the commercial sex industry is operating. If that city doesn't have strip clubs, then guaranteed it has women being advertised online for escorting, probably has massage parlors, probably has street prostitution. It's everywhere.
Right. So I'm assuming because you're a studier, and clearly you have a great brain and a heart for this, but tell me what the future looks like for you guys. How are you growing? What's next for Treasures? I mean, obviously you're going to continue doing what you're doing, but do you have plans? Like, what if the Lord put $1 million check in front of you for resourcing? Like, what would you do differently or greater? What's your plans? What's next?
Yeah. So we have lots of plans. Like, I've always got more vision than I've got staff to execute the vision. Gotcha. But one of the things that I'm actually really excited about is, you know, we're still doing our in-person trainings where people come to Los Angeles and we do hands-on training with them. And we love that. Okay. But for a lot of people, the travel, all that makes it a little less accessible. So we are in the process of digitizing our trainings to make them more accessible to people all over the world. So I'm super excited about that. We're also creating tracks for people who want to work and care for and reach and care for those that have been in the sex industry and victims of exploitation and trafficking, but also for churches and faith-based allies, training tracks for them as well. So we're super excited about that. If someone gave me $1 million tomorrow, probably the biggest need I see and one of the biggest wrestles we have is figuring out some transitional housing, because that's a huge need. I have a business plan written for it, but we're in Los Angeles, so the prices are very high here. Real estate's very expensive. And so that's just been something that's been in my heart for a long time. I have the plans for, but it's just a matter of needing lots of miracles.
We didn't get into this, and but I was going to ask that question. Is some people have home to go back to. I mean, it may be a tough journey back and a lot of apologies and a lot of broken relationships that have to be mended, but some people have no one. And how do they land? Like, what are they supposed to do when they leave and pay bills and
Shut
their back? Like, that's a big problem y'all have to overcome.
And that's a huge service gap. So even if a woman does end up going to, let's say, a residential program, and she gets that support for that period of time in that kind of very highly structured environment, what we often see for the population that we serve, they don't have homes to go to afterwards. There's no transition place for them. And so it's a huge service gap and a huge need. And, you know, many of the women that we serve experience homelessness. Many are homeless right now. Many are $100 away from being homeless. And so that's, it's a huge need. I have one woman online every week, almost, she's begging me to open a home.
Wow.
It's hard.
Or you guys, or churches. I mean, wouldn't it be great if churches could somehow have ministries? Because every one of our towns, there's somebody who needs a place to rest their head at night and be loved on.
Right.
An opportunity to
totally
change their life.
Right.
Instead of shunning them or looking down on them for.
Right. That's actually how the whole, one of the reasons the training started. There was a woman who reached out to us. She was from a small town. I encouraged her to find community in the local church. She went to the altar, asked for prayer. It was the pastor's wife. And she said, I'm really uncomfortable. I wish you weren't telling me this right now. And she was telling her, I was trafficked. I'm stuck in prostitution. I'm a single mom. I don't know how to get out. The next day, her car was vandalized with just profanity, calling her names. And then the next week, she went back to church thinking maybe it was a coincidence. And she got there and she went to check her child into the children's ministry. And they said, I'm sorry, you and your child are not welcome here. And I was devastated and angry and, I mean, all the feelings. But at the end of the day, I'm like, I'm heartbroken that the church did not rise to the occasion and be a safe place for a woman to experience healing and transformation. But it also showed me the importance of equipping the church to move beyond good intentions to actually reach and care for people in a way that's effective. And that's why we do the trainings we do.
Well, you have you use the word beast, Amelia. That's a great word. You're fighting a beast with a lot of arms and muscle and tentacles, and it's unfortunately it's never ending. You'll do this till Gabriel blows his horn, right?
I
mean, you're not going to solve it,
right?
But we can change people's lives with it and draw them to Christ. I mean, like you said, I think at the end of the day, your goal really is to pull them out of the industry and let them know they're loved. Mm-hmm. Somewhere along here is a faith journey, but it's not required. Yeah. You're not like I want you to repeat what you said. You're not asking them to change their behavior, then get in the club. It's just you're letting them know they're loved. And it's somewhere along the way, there's a gospel message, even if it's not, hey, memorize this verse. It's somebody loves you. I love you because I'm loved.
Right. I mean, I'm the biggest fan of wherever you go, preach the gospel and use words when necessary. And so we're not about behave, believe, and then you belong. Our message is you belong.
Oh, I love it. Love what you do.
Thank you.
I could do this all day, but we better wrap it up. I'm going to put a link to your website.
Awesome.
The podcast and let people know that there's a lot. You have a lot of videos and statistics to let people know that this is not as simple as we said earlier of just stripping industry where you take your clothes off, put them back on and leave, and then you just live life. It's a lot more dirty and complex than I think a lot of people imagine.
Very complex.
So thanks for everything that you do.
Yeah, my pleasure. Thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
No worries. Do you mind if I pray for you?
No, I'd love it.
Let's do it. Heavenly Father, Lord, you are an awesome God, Lord. During these current times that we're in, Lord, it's grateful to know that you and only you are in control of all things. In a lost and dark world, Lord, we thank you for being truth and light, Lord, and for your redemptive power and your desire to leave the 99, Lord, and go for the one. Lord, we thank you for that about you. Lord, we're thankful for people you put in our lives and that we get to meet. And Lord, today we lift up Harmony. Lord, of how you've given her a passion to walk into darkness and take young, broken women back into the light. Lord, thank you for giving her the strength and desire and the capacity and capability, Lord, to do this tough work, as she said, tackling a beast. Lord, thank you for walking with her during this ministry. That's what it is, Lord. And I ask you to continue blessing Harmony and her ministry, and then we ask you to grow this endeavor and expose the epidemic to those who could make a difference in helping her fight this dark and ugly world, Lord. Show yourself mightily that your truth will be exposed and to people that are just hurting, Lord, day in and day out, Lord. I pray for provisions for treasures. Give them the resources they need to continue their work and expand their work. Lord, we love you and we thank you for first loving us. And it's in your Son's precious name we pray.
Thank you for listening to today's episode of This Is His Story podcast.
Overwhelmed at all the technical terms, trends, options, cost, invoice signings for your organization's digital strategies? Join other leaders of Christian organizations as we join hands in our closed Facebook group. Go to creativedigitalguide.com/Facebook to register and apply for access. I'm only allowing executives of Christian organizations in. No vendors, no high-pressure sales, no gimmicks into this closed Facebook group. Sign up today and be encouraged and informed as you lead your Christian organization. Looking for a free resource to help your organization move the needle on new names and donors? Watch the 5 Simple Shifts to Gain Dedicated Donors with Your Digital Strategies webinar. Go to creativedigitalguide.com to register for this on-demand resource built exclusively for executive directors. creativedigitalguide.com for more information of gaining donors and telling stories that convert to new names and donations. Fund your God-sized mission.